It's so good to be with you this evening, and we're looking forward to this. I am. I'm going to make the subject of evil as exciting as I possibly can, okay? And let's pray, and we'll get started. Father, thank you so much for the time that we can have this evening to talk about such important things, things that shape the way we think, the way we feel, the way we make choices every day. And God, I pray that you would use this in a significant way in each one of our lives this evening. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, we are talking about the subject of evil, and we're going to be looking at it from the vantage point of alternate worldviews. So far, we've covered two other questions. We've talked about where did we come from, why are we here, and now then the subject of evil. What is evil? Where does it come from? That's what we want to look at this week and next week. This week we're looking at it from this alternate worldview point of view. Next week we're going to look at the biblical scriptures and see what it has to say. I think these 2 weeks will be eye-opening, to say the least, in a lot of different ways. Not only what's been shaping us, but what's shaping the world around us. Because this subject of evil is like a burr in the saddle to people of all beliefs, all faiths or non-faiths, for all time. What do we do with this thing called evil? Where did it come from? Why is it here? And we can deal with it philosophically at a broad level, but we also deal with it individually. Why do I do the things I do? Why do I think the things I think? Why do I do things I don't even want to do? Where does that come from? Why is it here? How does that relate to God? And it is something that plagues mankind to deal with this subject of evil. Where did it come from? Why is it here? Etc. Evil, the subject, has driven many people away from God. And it has brought many people, because of their inability to deal with it in their own life, brought many people to God, looking for help and hope in something outside of themselves. So it is one of those things that is very significant in each one of our lives and for all humanity. I see this written about in philosophical works almost as much as any other subject. Even if the subject has nothing to do with evil, it seems like you'll often see it creep in and have an effect upon a person. One such person is Friedrich Nietzsche. I'm sure you enjoyed your reading of Nietzsche this week, and I'm sure some of you got converted to Nietzsche this week. Probably not, but you have to realize this is something that he wrote in the late 1800s, a long time ago. You may not think that you are sophisticated enough to, or intellectual enough to read someone like Nietzsche, but I want to tell you that's the kind of writing that was pretty common back in those days, not just for education, not just in the institution. We think we're getting smarter and smarter all the time. I just want you to realize we are talking about subjects in here that people talked about going back 400 BC or before, that are those people are still influencing us today in many ways. And Nietzsche is one of those individuals. I'm not going to go through all the stuff that's in there about him. I chose for you to read what you did today because of him being the focal point of this particular study that we're looking at today, and because of his beliefs, and also because of the things that shaped him. Consider this. Nietzsche's two grandfathers on his mother and father's side, both of his grandfathers, were Lutheran pastors. His father was a Lutheran pastor who died when Nietzsche was 5 years old. His mother was a strong Lutheran Christian in her country. he went to school. His extended family got together after his father died and made it possible for him to go to school. And he went to some of the finest schools growing up as a young boy. When he was 21 years old, he decided he gave up on the idea of going into ministry like his grandfathers and his father, and instead went to the University of Leipzig. He was there for 4 years, got his degree when he was 25 years old, and at 25 years old was offered a teaching position in the university, and for 10 years taught at the university, Basel in Switzerland. There are some things that happened in his life besides those events that began to shape him and his views about God, about evil, and that sort of thing. One of those things was near the end of his time of teaching in Basel, before he retired from being a university professor at 35, he was called into the Corps during the Franco-Prussian War, called into service in the ambulance corps. So he spent several months, it was less than a year, but he spent several months going out and collecting young men who were on the front who had been wounded or killed in battle and taking them back to where they could either be buried or where they could be operated on or whatever they needed. And he saw evil in a very uninspiring, I guess you could say, a very lethal dose of evil for him. And it shook him. Something else happened because of that, though. Just a few months doing that, he also was faced and around a lot of disease, and he caught some of those bugs when he was in there. And for the rest of his life, his health was an issue for him. He struggled with his health. He died in his 50s because of his health issues, so he never lived to be a very old man at all because of those health issues. Another thing happened during that period of time. While he was teaching in university at Basel, there was another man who was teaching at another university named Robert Wagner. And Robert Wagner became someone that he was intrigued by. He studied him, considered himself a disciple of Robert Wagner. Robert Wagner was a much older man than him at this time. And Robert Wagner, just so you know, Robert Wagner is the one who introduced some of the philosophical ideas that led to the Third Reich and Adolf Hitler and Nazi Germany. He was influenced by Darwin and the whole idea of the evolution and the survival of the fittest and how humanity had risen to the top of the pile, if you will, of all created beings, or all beings, not created, but all beings, and all that. And he said, you know what? That not only applies to people, but that applies to races. And he introduced the idea that there is one race that has risen to the top of all others, the Aryan race, the German race. And he introduced that idea philosophically in the university, and it became very popular very quickly in Germany, and it's something that Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party picked up on and began to preach that, literally. So he was a close student of, at a distance, but a student of Wagner until Nietzsche started writing himself and got a little popularity, and Wagner cut him off, had nothing to do with him. He was a very aloof kind of person, would have nothing to do with him anymore. And that really hurt Nietzsche in a lot of different ways and made him bitter about that. Now, some other things influenced him. He was a student of Greek and German literature. So he read some of the great philosophers, Greek philosophers, and Greek history, and he was fascinated with the nation of Greece as it the rise and fall of the Greece nation, so to speak. And he studied that, and what he came to believe was Greece flourished as a nation as long as their primary god, or the god that they elevated the most, was Dionysus. In fact, in the paper that you read by him today, he mentions Dionysus, spent over a page of material dealing with Dionysus. And he was fascinated with Dionysus, who was the god of the vine, the god of wine, women, song, wild, zesty living, and that sort of thing. And he said, you know, the Greeks, when they worshipped him as their primary god, really seemed to flourish. But when Apollo started being their primary god, he was much more about discipline and rules and rigid. And that's where the nation of Greece began to fall. And then he looked at Christianity in his part of the world, and he said, you know what? It seems like before Christianity got a foothold here, that's what was happening. Our nation was growing, but it brought in all these rules and all this discipline stuff, and it's really what's killing the European economy, the European lifestyle, and that sort of thing. And he was very anti-Christian because of that influence. He was also influenced by Darwin, as many were during that day in university settings, and his whole idea of the survival of the fittest. And if you've heard of expressions like the end justifies the means, that is something that Nietzsche was a proponent of. It doesn't matter what it takes to get to the top. It's just the way we have evolved. That's what we're supposed to do, is get to the top no matter what, no matter who we have to step on, or no matter what we have to do to get there. That's okay, because what's important is getting to the top. Okay? Now, that's Nietzsche in many ways. And you can see how in his early years, just from the brief description I've given you, how he was influenced by evil, and some of his ideas about evil spread throughout his writings as well. Now then, with that in mind, let's look at our five alternate worldviews. We'll come back to Nietzsche in a little bit as we go through these. The first one of these personal worldviews, there in that first column on that chart that you have, is a personal theistic substitute for God. We're talking about deism, finite godism, open theism to a certain extent as well. There is a personal creator God, number one there, who created mankind and allowed the possibility of evil to exist in the world. There would be different ones who are deists who would espouse how that happened differently. A pure deist would say, you know what, mankind messed up God's plan, his system. We didn't read what God had given us right. We didn't read the stars. We didn't study well enough, and we messed up God's design, and that's what led to evil. Mankind did that. Some pure deists would associate that. You will hear very few deists ever talk about Satan, because once again, that would admit that there is a supernatural being or influence in this world, and they don't believe in the supernatural involvement. So they wouldn't often, most of them would not talk about Satan being an influence in this area of evil at all either. But they would just say, we mess things up. A finite God is someone who's sort of a Superman view of God, that he's strong and capable, but who is just not able to be every place at all times and take care of everything. He's sort of a superhuman, sort of a mythical kind of God from Greek mythology, more like a Superman kind of a person. And they would look at all of this and they would say, you know what, God created this world, but it just got out of control for him. He just couldn't keep up with it, and that's what led to evil. in the world. He just couldn't keep up with it. It was more than he could handle once he created this world and people and all of that as well. So those would be some of the distinctions that would be made. Number two, evil has become a human problem that adversely affects human society and the quality of life which people have. Evil is, in many ways, that which is or the result of men going against the systems that God created that we already talked about. Number three, what is good and evil becomes self-evident through cause and effect observed experience. There's that phrase again that we talked about before. It will become, what is evil? Well, it will become self-evident. Is this evil or is this evil? Well, it'll become obvious. It'll become clear to us as we just watch it play itself out, watch the cause and effect thing go on. We will be able to figure it out, what is evil and that sort of thing. Look down at the bottom at the quotes, about halfway down that page. There's about five lines that are underlined there at the very beginning of that quote. Let me read those, follow along. After men have found by experience, would you circle that, by experience, that their selfishness and confined generosity acting at their liberty totally incapacitate them for society and at the same time have observed, would you circle that, have observed, that society is necessary to the satisfaction of those very passions, they are naturally induced, would you circle that, naturally induced, to lay themselves under the restraint of such rules, would you circle rules, as may render their commerce more safe and commodious. Just to give you some of the language I've already talked about, they would say it'll become self-evident, it'll become obvious. And there are these systems or laws of nature, laws of creation that God put in place that we need to get consistent with. We need to understand them. We need to get consistent with them. And these things, we will figure out we're messing up by experience, by observation, and that sort of thing. We'll figure it out. We'll do that. Look at the very bottom of the page. There's a few lines, that last paragraph at the very bottom of the page, a quote from Thomas Jefferson. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience hath shown. There's that experience word again. It has shown us something. We have learned something from experience, that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. It's the forms that they have gotten accustomed to that has led to the evil, led to the problem, and they haven't been willing to give it up, and that sort of thing. Just to give you a couple of ideas from their own words of the things I'm talking about. What is good and evil becomes self-evident. We discover those things. We can't go to the Bible. The Bible would be considered supernatural. That would infer that God was involved in this world in some way. So we can't go there. We have to examine. We have to, by experience, by observation, and those kind of things, figure out these laws, these systems that God has put into place. And we will figure it out. Number four, good and evil can be systematized into a set of do's and don'ts or general rules, and these rules must be followed. So what they're saying is we figure out what is good and what is evil by observation, and then we create rules that elevate the good and that put evil in its place. So you do these things, and you don't do these things, and it becomes very rules-oriented. Think about the 17, 1800s when it comes to rules, when it comes to not just in the church, but worldwide. Think about the rules that came into play during those periods of time. It's amazing. how long-lasting and how much of an impact those had on so many people, even today, from the rules that were instituted. This is the way you do it. This is the way we've done it. We've always done it, and it should be done because we've learned from experience. This is the way you do it. I would be willing to say that some of us were brought up in homes where that was what was taught and the way it was taught. This is what you do. This is how you do it. Why? Well, that doesn't matter. We've learned this is how you do it. You just do it this way. And that has been something that has been preached within the church and outside of the church for several centuries now, because of this whole idea. We've got to figure out what's right and wrong, and we create rules that elevate the good and that put evil back in its place, that sort of thing. Now, number five there, let me read it, but put that in parentheses because really that's the next issue we're going to deal with. If a person does more of the do's in life than the don'ts, then society will grow and flourish, and that will be acceptable to God. That's really getting into, well, can anything be done about evil? That's the next issue we're going to be dealing with. But it's just saying we need to focus on the do's, eliminate the don'ts by following the rules. Rules of society, rules within the church, rules within the government, all kinds of social rules. There were rules for how a man was supposed to act in the home and how the wife was supposed to act in the home. There were rules about parents and children and how they were supposed to relate with one another. There were rules in a township, how it was supposed to function, and what were things that were acceptable and unacceptable, and they created laws and rules for those things. Now, I'm not saying that to say all rules or all laws are bad, but I'm saying this is something that deism and this personal theistic substitute for God really reiterated. If this is not something we can go to for truth, then we got to figure it out, and we've got to come up with a way of getting people to do the right things and not do the wrong things. And so a substitute for the Bible became the laws for a lot of people, a lot of townships, a lot of governments, a lot of individuals, a lot of homes. That became a substitute for biblical truth. And in many cases within Christianity, it became a blend of the two. It became a blend of reading the Bible, but then saying, now, here are the rules that go along with that. So this is this particular view. They would say, if you want to change society, you change the laws. So a pure deist today would say, do you want to change the course of America? Well, then you need to change the laws. That's how you change things, is through laws. That's what changes things. They would not deal with people's hearts changing or those kind of things. They would deal with, you got to change the outward laws. That's how you deal with it. That's how you change everything. As I go through these views, I would not write on any statement at all that I am a deist or that I'm a pantheist or I'm a dualist that we're going to get into in a few minutes or any. I wouldn't subscribe to any of these views we're looking at tonight on just about anything. And yet when I look at my life, the sad reality is I have made choices like these views, every one of them. Hey, rules are easier than having to use discernment. Okay? Rules are easier than memorizing 10 or 12 rules is a whole lot easier than letting this whole book become something that transforms my life. And become familiar with it, to read it, and to study it, that's a lot of work. If I can just memorize 10 or 12 rules, then that's a whole lot easier to live by. It's just so much easier to fall into that, to go in that direction. Same is true for this next area, an impersonal theistic substitute for God on the next page, the second alternate worldview. I'm using the word theistic very loosely, and I'm using atheistic very loosely when we get to those last two views. When I talk about theistic, I'm saying they're a person who you ask them, do you believe there is a God? And they would say yes. So I'm in a theistic sense, they believe there is a God. A personal theistic person view would say, well, yes, I believe there is a God, and they would generally refer to the God of the Bible that's talked about in the Bible. They might not take you to the Bible, but they would refer to the Creator God, the one who created all of this. This impersonal theistic view of God, do you believe in God? They would say, yes, I believe in God. But what they're talking about when they talk about God is usually the universe in some form or fashion, whether they're a pantheist or a panentheist, a New Age view and that sort of thing, which takes on a lot of different forms in America today, particularly. But when you say all that, they believe in God, but God is not a person, not a personal God. It's an impersonal God. It's a thing. It's called the universe, and this universe is God. So, number one, God or nature is the essence of the power and material of the universe, which has eternally existed, or some others might say, God is made up of the visible universe, his body, and the invisible universe. His soul is in the process of becoming all it will become. So God is developing all the time. Internally within this universe and all of that. Number two, God just is, and so mankind as a part of God just is. So when we talk about where do we come from, well, we've always existed because the universe is eternal, it's God, it's always existed, and we've always existed in some form. We just keep coming back to in different forms and that sort of thing. This leads to, because this is true, there is no actual good and evil. When you read the pantheistic and panentheistic literature, mainly Hinduism, Buddhism, which was a spinoff of Hinduism, when you read some of the other writers from the Western world that we've talked about before in here about this subject, evil doesn't, good nor evil really exist. This universe just is. It's not a good universe. It's not a bad universe. It just is. It just is. And they will often talk about things like, look at number three, man's mind, which is inventive, and our emotions, which are tied to our minds, lead us to believe in such a thing as good and evil. It's all in your head. It's just a matter of perspective. That's what you've been, you would hear, I've heard this at university. Rick, that's just the way you were raised. It's in your head that way. You got to get it out of your head. You got to stop thinking that way. If you don't think about what you call bad things that you do, then if you just don't think about them as being bad, they're just things that you do. You're part of the universe. It just happens. You're thinking wrong, and that's what's leading to you to feel guilty about things and feeling like you ought to deal with certain things. You really shouldn't have to do that, Rick. Look down below at the quotes down there. The first underlined section in that first paragraph. As for the terms good and bad, all this is, by the way, taken from Spinoza, a Western writer, As for the terms good and bad, they indicate no positive quality in things regarded in themselves. There is nothing that's truly good or bad, but are merely modes of thinking or notions. That's all that good or evil really are, he says. Modes of thinking or notions. They're in our head, which we form from the comparison of things one with another. Thus, one and the same thing can be at the same time good, bad, and indifferent. It just depends on who's looking at it. Okay, now there's a certain degree of truth in all of that. Depending on different perspectives, different things can be seen in different ways. But when you talk about absolute good and bad, something that is always wrong or something that is always good, they would say those are really just notions that we have. Those are just ways of thinking that we've been brought up with that are incorrect. I remember reading years ago one of the first great Hindu priests came to America, and he was popular back in the 70s. And I remember reading in Time magazine an interview with him. And one of the first things he says is, what Americans need to do is stop thinking so much. He said if they wanted to get in tune with God, speaking of the universe, they would take their brains, put them into a little box, lock it up, and throw it away. Okay? He was being very honest with what he believed. What's gotten Americans into trouble is the way we think about things. We shouldn't think so much. Just get rid of your minds, and you won't have any problems anymore. And truly, that is the case, isn't it? I mean, if you took my brain out, I would die and I would have no more problems, so to speak. But I don't think he was quite thinking about it that way. So that's the thing. Now, also in their literature, they would even go to the point of talking about things like pain. Pain doesn't really exist. It's all in your mind. And you can read their literature and you can see that being talked about. You just need to think differently about it. It's just all in your mind. And we'll talk some more about that in a second. Number four, absolute evil does not really exist, but we can call good that which helps us to be more like our nature, more like we were designed to be, and we can call evil that which takes us further from our nature. So, have you heard things like, hey, we're sexual beings. We were created to have sex, so what's the problem? Just go do what you were made to do, what you were designed to do. That's your nature. You've heard the expression, it's just sex. That's part of who we are. That's part of this kind of thinking. We're thinking about things wrong. And so if we just need to think differently about things, and it'll be okay. We've made certain things good or evil in absolute sense that really aren't that way according to this view. But for the sake of discussion, let's just call things good that are natural to us, that come natural to us. Think about that being broadcast to our world today all the time. It is. Just do what comes natural. That's what's good and everything. It totally ignores our propensity to live differently than God designed us to, called sin. Our propensity to go in that direction. Totally teaching in an opposite direction of that altogether. Look at the second paragraph in that first section there of the quotes. It starts off with, in what follows then, I shall mean by good that which we certainly know to be a means of approaching more nearly to the type of human nature which we have set before ourselves, by bad that which we certainly know to be a hindrance to us in approaching the said type. So once again, just do what comes natural. We'll call that good. When you don't do what's natural, that's bad. Okay? Can you see, basically, from a biblical point of view, taking good and evil and flipping it on its head and saying, do whatever you feel like doing, do whatever comes natural to you, that's the good thing to do. That's what you ought to do. And if you have any remorse or if you do anything that requires self-discipline, that's bad. That's bad altogether. So in summary of this particular view, all that exists is God, this universe, eternally. God is amoral, not defined by good and evil, just existence. Therefore, good and evil do not really exist. Get rid of false notions of good and evil and guilt and that sort of thing. Just do what comes natural to you. Okay, the next view, dualism. A compromised dualistic substitute for God. Again, I'm talking primarily about Plato, even though there would be other people I will quote from time to time in this view. Very few people have written as extensively as Plato or who were as influential in this view as Plato, going all the way back to 300 and 400 BC when he wrote about it. But he had the idea that there were, when we talk about dualism, two eternal realities, and only two. Okay? One was called good. That was the mind, thinking, reason, logic. Not the brain, but the mind, thinking. That sort of thing. That is good. It's always been there, always will be there. Do you see how closely related that is to what we just looked at? Instead of saying the universe has always been there, thinking, thought, reason, logic has always been there, and it's always been good. And the physical world, which includes our physical bodies, have always been here in some form, and they are eternally evil. Always have been, always will be. Can't change that. Can't make this human body be good because it is inherently, eternally part of matter, part of things, and it's evil. Only thoughts, reason, logic, knowledge is good. Always has been, always will be. That's the only thing that is. So let's look at the implications of that. Number one, there are two equally coexisting eternal realities, the eternal material world, which is evil, and the eternal immaterial wisdom, mind, reason, thought, logic, which is good. And the reason I talk about Plato so much is because today we wouldn't necessarily talk about good, mind, evil, material world eternally, and those are the two eternal realities. We wouldn't talk about that. But we live in this dualistic mindset of we can live in two worlds. Again, we can have our church world and we can have our day-to-day world. We can have our at-home world and we can have our work or school world. We can live in these two different realms and we feel like that's okay. And that's what Plato said. That's what we live in is two different worlds. We just change what those worlds are. From culture to culture, person to person, quite often. Number two, therefore, everything that is material, including the body of a person, is eternally evil. The very nature of all things material is evil, and it will do evil eternally. Look below, the first paragraph down there, the first three lines anyway, that are underlined. This is by Plato. It's Socrates speaking. Remember, especially the first two-thirds of the writings of Plato were mostly dialogues that Socrates had with students, with those who were studying under him in some form or fashion or debating him. And here is Socrates speaking in this dialogue. Evils, Theodorus, can never be done away with. Okay? Evils, Theodorus, the guy he's speaking to, can never be done away with. For the good must always have its contrary. Nor have they any place in the divine world, but they must needs haunt this region of our mortal nature. They're eternal. Evil, this evil material world is eternal. It's always been here, always will be. He goes on and he says, that is why we should make all speed to take flight from this world to the other, and that means becoming like the divine so far as we can, and again, is to become righteous with the help of wisdom, knowledge, reason, logic, etc., the mind, thought. Just to give you some from their own words. Number three, up above, people are not responsible for the evil that they do. They have no choice since it is an innate part of who they are, and it always will be. I'm a material person. I'm made of material. I'm part of the evil material world. Therefore, I have no choice but to do evil things. I will do that. Most everything I do is evil in some form or fashion, they would say. And I have no alternative. Have you ever thought or heard someone say, that's just the way I am. I can't help it. We would be agreeing with Socrates, agreeing with Plato, in his dualistic view of life, that the material world, that my human body, that who I am as a human being, is inherently evil, and I have no alternative, no choice. I can't help it. That's just who I am. And we fall into that trap of going along with this. Number four, just accept evil as a natural part of life and go on. You are an involuntary victim. In fact, you will see that little verb, that little phrase, involuntary victim, or something like it, over and over again when they get on the subject of evil and how it relates to mankind. Look down below at the second paragraph. Socrates again speaking, and evil is done much more abundantly than good by all men from childhood upward, erring, how? Involuntarily. They're sinning, they're practicing evil involuntarily. It's just who they are. They don't have a choice. Look at the very bottom paragraph. This is another longer conversation here, but look at the last underlined part of a sentence. Though detriment thus caused is popularity taken to be involuntary wrong. There's that little phrase again, involuntary wrong. They would say, we just can't help it. That's just who we are. And we hear that preached from the rooftops and from in the schoolhouses all across America, around the world today. We hear that taught all the time. That's just who you are. That's you can't help it. Just accept it. That's who you are. Okay. That's this dualistic substitute for God. In summary, the material physical part of life is eternally evil. Since I am innately evil, I am helpless, victim of evil. Don't fall victim to guilt. It is useless. You will never get rid of the evil that you are and that exists in your life. You just need to learn how to accentuate the good, which is your mind. Education, learning, thought, reason, logic, that is how you can put evil more and more in its place, Plato would say, along with others. Now then, the fourth view, the fourth alternate worldview. An impersonal atheistic substitute for God, and then we're going to look at a personal atheistic substitute for God. sort of going along with what we've looked at before, impersonal atheistic. Again, I'm using atheistic very loosely. If you ask this person, do you believe in God? They would say no. That's what I mean by atheistic in a loose sense in these two views. Do you believe in God? They would say no. But when you talk to them further, or in the case of the people we're going to be looking at, when you read further in the things that they've written, they do attribute absolute authority to something, or superiority of a unnatural scale to something else, something that controls, something that is in charge. They will refer to a person or a thing that way, but they would say to you, no, I don't believe in God. So this would be an atheist person, or it could be an agnostic person who says, well, I don't know that you can ever know for sure that there is a God, and if you could, it wouldn't make any difference. So number one, there is no creator God to look to or to count on as a standard for good and evil. You might just add this little sentence to the rest of number one there. But there is an impersonal force or reality that functions like a God. But there is an impersonal force or reality that functions like a God. And I'll mention some of those again that we've talked about. History. Karl Marx would talk about human history has a mind of its own, and it is controlling what's going on. We could talk about nature, and Mother Nature is in charge. You better not fool with Mother Nature, or you're going to get zapped by her in some form or fashion. B.F. Skinner talked about the environment determined everything in a person's life. So he gives that sort of a controlling power over us. Wherever we're born and the context or the environment in which we grow up and where we live and everything else determines everything, that is, he would not call that a God, but it is a substitute for God in some form or fashion. Some would refer to the mind that way as well, but we'll move on. Look at number one below. Look at the first paragraph down below, just the first 2.5 lines there. This is from Karl Marx, speaking about human history. Men make their own history, but they do not make it just as they please. They do not make it under circumstances chosen by themselves, but under circumstances directly encountered, given, and transmitted from the past. We make choices, but they are choices within the dictates of the past. The past what? Past history. That wheel of history that's moving along. And we see that it's just coming along over and over again. Look at the second paragraph down below where it says in the WPM, you may not have run across that. That's the World Pantheistic Movement. That's what they call themselves. This is from their website, from a pantheistic website. In the WPM, we take the real universe and nature as our starting and finishing point, not some preconceived idea of God. We feel a profound wonder and awe for these, similar to the reverence that believers in more conventional gods feel towards their deity, but without anthropomorphic worship or belief that nature has a mind or personality that can influence through the prayer or ritual. Our ethics are humanistic and green. So we believe that nature, they're talking about here, the universe, the real universe and nature are our starting and finishing point. And we worship them, we stand in awe of them, and that sort of thing. But they're not a person, they're not an anthropomorphic, yes, anthropomorphic, yeah, I can't even say it now. Anyway, they're not a person in any way whatsoever. Goodness. Number two, up above, therefore, there is no such absolute thing as evil, only wise and foolish. And you will hear them talk about being wise versus foolish. Number three, foolishness is getting out of step. This would be the closest thing they would have to what they call evil. Foolishness is getting out of step with the sovereign force that is at work today, whether history, nature, the environment, or the mind, and that sort of thing. Wisdom is learning from those things and getting in step with them. So foolishness is getting out of step with that which is ultimate, with human history, getting out of step with the cycle of history that you are on right now. You get out of step with it, you're going to get rolled over by it. You get out of step with nature, and you're going to pay a price. We're going to destroy the nature, which will end up destroying us as well. The environment, we've got to respect that and everything, or the mind, etc. Wisdom is learning from those things and getting on the good side of those things as well. But foolishness is getting out of step with that which is ultimate in their view. Look down below, again, that first paragraph where we left off before. The third line down, about halfway through that, it says, "The tradition of all dead generations weighs like a nightmare on the brain of the living. And just when they seem engaged in revolutionizing themselves and things in creating something that has never yet existed precisely in such periods of revolutionary crisis, then anxiously conjure up the spirits of the past to their service and borrow from them." They learn from the past and move on from them. Number four up above, mankind should avoid foolishness, pursue wisdom for his own sake and for the sake of the world. Look at the very last, the second to the last short paragraph, five lines up from the very bottom of that page. It says, "In the WPM, we revere and care for nature. We accept this life as our only life and this earth as our only paradise if we look after it." This is all there is. We've got to take care of it. This is the best we're going to get. This is heaven if we will make it that way and take care of it. And so there's not only a worship in this view of nature quite often for those who put nature as what is ultimate. And again, you can see how closely related this is to Spinoza and what he talked about before. But this whole idea, this is where nature is probably the biggest discussion today, from a pantheistic point of view, from an impersonal atheistic substitute for God. That substitute most often today is nature. And we look at that and we feel not only a need or a desire to take care of nature, we feel a have to. Because if we don't, it's going to punish us. It's going to get even with us if we don't do that. So what is evil? There really is no such thing as evil. There's just foolishness. There's just foolishness. Not taking care of that which is ultimate. Okay. The last of these five views, a personal atheistic substitute. They believe, they don't, if you ask them, "Do you believe in God?" they would say no. But when they start talking about what is ultimate, they would refer to a person in some form or fashion. So they might refer to humanity as a whole, or they might refer to a person, me. I'm what's ultimate. Humanism. So under that, number one, there is no creator God to look to or to count on as a standard for good and evil. But that, similar to what we did on the last one, let's put another sentence in there. But there is another person who is supreme, the individual man or woman or mankind. But there is another person who is supreme. There's no creator God to look to or to count on as a standard for good and evil. But there is another person who is supreme, the individual man or woman or mankind. And number two, mankind is a product which has risen to the top of the evolutionary mountain by the achieved superiority of previous beings before them. So we have risen to the mountaintop of all created beings. and of the animal kingdom. And number three, mankind must accept his superior role in this world by pursuing to be God himself in this life. Does that sound like Nietzsche to you, by the way? You just need to accept the fact that you are ultimate. You are what's most important in this life. Not just most important, but you are not accountable to anyone except to yourself because you are ultimate. You need to act that way. Take that responsibility. And number four, therefore, each person must decide for themselves what is their own personal right or wrong, good or evil, wise or foolish choices. And then I add, because they add, within limits, considering the whole of society. That last little phrase there, within limits, considering the whole of society, is a cop-out for humanism. For a pure humanist to say, well, we got to take into consideration society. Really? I thought I was ultimate. I thought I was not accountable to anyone or responsible. I thought I made my own choices. I thought I made my own decisions about what's right and wrong for me. But because that doesn't work, can you, what is it when every man does what is right in his own eyes? Anarchy. And because we can't live with the results of humanism in its purest form, we have to go back and change it a little bit. We have to blur it a little bit, compromise it a little bit, and say, but, and you will hear people say things like, as a humanist, I'm what's most important, I'm what's ultimate. They would say, but for my own self-preservation, I need to make sure we as a society are getting along. Okay? But when you stop and think about that, that is not what Nietzsche and others would be encouraging us to do. I don't figure out how to get along so I can survive. I figure out how to eliminate all those that would be a threat to me. That's pure humanism. I figure out how to do that. How do I get rid of anyone else that would be a threat to me? That's what I need to do. I need to rise to the top, not figure out how I can be safe from a pure humanistic point of view. So, interesting little commentary on this in history. If you go back to Judges chapter 17 through 21, the last few chapters of the book of Judges in the Old Testament. In chapter 17, there is a little phrase, there was no king in Israel, and every man did what was right in his own eyes. And then the book in chapter 21 concludes with the other bookend of that, there was no king in Israel, and every man did what was right in his own eyes. When you read chapter 17 through 21, what goes in between those two bookend statements? It's probably the most horrid picture that we have in the Bible. It's one of the most horrible pictures of civilization that exists today in written form. It is unbelievably horrific to see what happens when every man does what is right in his own eyes. Okay? If you want to get a little glimpse of that, go read those gruesome chapters and you'll see what happens when every man does what's right in his own eyes, when truly live by a humanistic philosophy of life. I'm what's ultimate. I decide for myself. Now, look below. That very first paragraph in the quotes down there. This is written by Epicurus around, we don't know exactly when he wrote this, but this would have been written around 300 BC. He was a later contemporary of Plato, Aristotle. He says this, "For we recognize pleasure as the first good and as inborn. It is from this that we begin every choice and every avoidance. It is to pleasure that we have recourse, using the feeling as our standard for judging every good." You ever hear a phrase like, if it feels good, do it? We would be raising our hands with Epicurus on that. He would say, what is good? Well, what is good is whatever brings you pleasure. And if it doesn't bring you pleasure, then it's bad. And we need to understand that. By the way, Epicurus, with that kind of thinking, also introduced something that we still buy into, even often in a Christian culture we will buy into. If pleasure is good to Epicurus, pain is what? Evil. It's bad. It's not good. It's the opposite to him. And he talked about pain being that which is evil, anything that brings us pain. And we still buy into that today in our culture. In our Western American church culture, we would say, we wouldn't say pleasure is the only good thing and everything, but we would say pain is evil. It's bad. You know what disease a person has who cannot feel pain? It's called leprosy. And they usually end up dying because, not from the leprosy necessarily, but because of the injuries that they get because they cannot feel any pain. So they can't feel that their garment just caught on fire from the campfire and is burning their whole backside. They can't feel it. Et cetera, et cetera. They can't feel that they broke a bone or that they just can't feel. And it leads to not such a pretty picture, a hard thing in their life when that happens. But we tend to continue to think that all pain is evil. And it's not, biblically. We'll look at that next week a little bit more. Look at the very last paragraph down below. This is taken from William James, a more contemporary writer than some of these others. Wrote this in 1902. The young bird compared to some of these others we've been looking at. He says, much of what we call evil is due entirely to the way men take the phenomenon. By the way, William James was a renowned professor, teacher, prolific writer. He says, much of what we call evil is due entirely to the way men take the phenomenon. It can so often be converted into a bracing and tonic good by a simple change of the sufferer's inner attitude from one of fear to one of fight. Since you make them evil or good by your own thoughts about them, it is the ruling of your thoughts which proves to be your principal concern. And William James would go along with what we looked at in some of the other views before. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Evil, pain, those kind of things, it's all in your head. It's what your mind makes of it. So just change your mind about it. Think about it a different way, and it will go away altogether. So what is, to a humanist, a person who believes I, personally, and what is ultimate, and I am responsible to no one but me, I make my own determinations, what is evil to me? What is good to me? What is evil to me is whatever I determine it to be. That's what evil is. It's whatever I determine it is. I determine what is good and evil. I am the standard by which I measure that which is good and that which is evil. That which goes along with what I want, which helps me get what I want, that feels good to me maybe, that is good. Anything that gets in my way, anything that blocks what I want, anything that doesn't feel good to me, that's evil. I determine that. And you determine that for yourself. So if you get in my way, that's why I was saying a while ago about a pure humanist, if you get in my way, you are evil. And my responsibility as the human who is ultimate is to get rid of evil, which means I get rid of you and you and you and you and you. Okay? Because you're in my way of getting what I want in some form or fashion. And that's nothing wrong with that, because I determine what's right and wrong. I determine what's good and what's evil and what isn't. From a humanity point of view, a group who would say, or a person who would say, I think humanity is what is ultimate, just Darwinism at its purest form, humanity is what is ultimate and that sort of thing, then I would fall into the group that would say, therefore we need to get groupings of people together. We need to, you've seen the show Survival? How many of you have seen that show? I've only watched it a few times, but every time I've watched it, I notice that they're trying to make alliances with other people and to get groups together to protect themselves and that sort of thing. That's what a person who believes humanity is what is ultimate. We've got to get together as groups of people, societies, here in our culture where we're at right now. We need to get together and we need to have people around us that can help us, can protect us, and that sort of thing. We need to do that, or we would be threatened by others who would threaten us, or by other species that would threaten us as well. So whatever we determine is right is right. By the way, within this social thing, once again, there's a very progressive view of government, politics, and that sort of thing. And that is, we are constant, as a society, let's assume we are a society right here. And we are growing and developing and changing and evolving, and everything they would say. Therefore, we need to have laws that provide and protect us, to take care of us, and everything. And as we change, the majority determines how the laws ought to change. And so the laws need to change to keep up with what we need as a group. And the laws need to change. There are no eternal rights and wrongs. There's just what kind of laws will protect us and provide us and make us feel good and do things that we want to do. Okay, enough of that. Let's look at the last page in review. Some final thoughts. Would you star number one, or circle the number one there, or something? Without a personal creator God who defines good by his own being and who communicates that to mankind, mankind is helpless to define good and evil or to explain where it comes from, and underline that last word, adequately. You can tell me all you want that evil doesn't really exist, but I know what I go through. I know what goes on in my head, in my heart. I know the choices I make. Even when I make up my own laws for myself, I violate them. Okay? And I break them. Why do I do that? There is nothing here. You can say it doesn't really exist, it's all in your mind and everything else, but for the average person, for 99% of people, that is not adequate when they deal with it and live with it day in and day out. We live with evil. I'll never forget the first time. I mean, we had raised our children talking about good and evil and the stories in the Bible, and we had done all of those things, brought them up in the church where they had good teaching. We taught them a lot as well. I'll never forget driving down the street, though, and I was teaching at the university. It was a small town, big university. We're driving down this Midwestern Main Street town, in this town, and there was on the top of the corner building at Main and Broadway, right in the middle of town, on the top of the tallest building there, there was an observatory up there with people always stationed with binoculars. And I remember they were always looking into the sky. And I remember the boys, very young at that time, they were preschool and first grade. And the two boys saying, "Dad, why are those guys always up there with those binoculars?" And I said, "Well, we really don't have any kind of early warning system here for things." And they said, "Like what?" I said, "Well, a tornado and that sort of thing. Or also, because I knew this to be a fact in that city, in case there was ever any kind of attack on this city by air." What do you mean, attack on this city by air? "Well, you know, missiles or airplanes that might want to come and bomb." Why would they want to bomb us? Why would anyone want to do that? And I remember the puzzlement in their eyes that we live in a world where people make evil choices. And it befuddled them. It's like, why would they want to hurt us? Why would they want to send a missile here? Why would they want to bomb here? Why would they want to do that? And we as mankind, in that simple, elementary kind of mindset, ask that basic, why? Why does it exist? Why do we as human beings do the things that we do? And without a personal creator God who defines by his very character what is good, God is good. And he defines what is good by his very nature, his very character. And without that, and him communicating that to us in some form through the scriptures we have, we will never be able to understand or explain evil adequately. Number two, so each person naturally starts making up his or own system of laws or rules, but this becomes unworkable for society. So everybody, all these different views, all these different alternate worldviews, there are people all over our city tonight who believe those different alternate worldviews. And they're making judgment calls about what is right and what is wrong, what is good and what is evil, based upon their worldview, based upon where they're coming from. And we're trying to live together. We're trying to coexist together as in a community and have common laws and enjoy life together in this community. And yet we're approaching this basic issue of good and evil from such diverse directions. So the person sitting next to you or standing next to you in line at the grocery store when you're picking up something to eat or buying something at the store is going to have a very different view about what is good or evil when it comes to the exchange of money that's going on there. If I can get away with it, it's good. I remember playing a board game with a neighbor, and they kept cheating at the game. And I finally, after about the third time, I said, "You're cheating." She says, "Well, if you don't get caught, it's not wrong." Tells me a little bit about her worldview, you know? If you don't get caught, it's not wrong. So, number three, therefore, the pressure of society is to eventually create small social laws to avoid total anarchy. We've got to do that. We've got to come up with laws. Again, remember, everybody looks at the law of the land from their worldview perspective. I remember watching the movie Pirates of the Caribbean for the first time, and one of the funniest lines in that movie was when this girl, I don't remember all the names, but this girl was saying, what about the law of the pirates? And he says, well, they're really not laws. They're more like suggestions. And it's like, it just blew her mind. Wait a minute, I thought there was honor among thieves. Well, sort of, but we are thieves, you know. I mean, come on. And that sort of thing. But we try to make laws, but everybody interprets how you deal with those laws differently. Are those laws suggestions? Are those laws guidelines? Are those laws in the way of me being my own God? And we create laws, but it doesn't work in society for very long, and we have to keep coming up with more laws and stricter enforcement of those laws and more punishments and that sort of thing. Why? If we are so good, if we have risen so far in the evolutionary cycle, why are our prisons so full that they're having to let people out, even though their time is not up? Why? Why do we not have a solution to that? Evil is alive and well on planet Earth, and we can ignore it, we can deny it, we can act like it's not there, we can call it something different, whatever, but it's alive and well on planet Earth. Number four, then mankind is in a bind to explain why we need all these personal and social laws or rules. Why do we need them? Because you see, they have no explanation for human depravity whatsoever. And number five, mankind is helpless to explain evil adequately and consistently apart from revelation from God. Well, that's a good introduction for next week, because next week we're going to look at revelation from God in the Bible about what does he say about evil. This next week is, in fact, the next 3 weeks are three of my favorite weeks in this class. I think there will be more eye-opening going on next week as we look back on this week, and then we look next week at what the Bible has to say about evil and that sort of thing. And then the next 2 weeks, talking about what can be done about it. What does the world say? What does the Bible say? Three of my favorite weeks in this whole semester. Okay, let me pray. Father, thank you so much for who you are. Thank you that you are good. Thank you that you have communicated to us, not only in your general revelation, your creation that we can see, but you've given us black and white ink on paper. You've given us words that we can see and read and understand and research and understand what you're saying about what is good, what is evil, what you are like, what you are not like. God, I thank you for that. Just thank you for giving that to us, helping us to see that. Thank you for giving us Jesus. Not only for paying the penalty for our sin, but living a living demonstration of what is good. And giving us words of wisdom about what is evil. God, I thank you for his life that we could see here on planet Earth as well. Help us this week as we study the passages and look at what you have to say about good and evil. God, this is so crucial. We are so influenced in this area. The deceiver wants us to believe the things that we've heard tonight are true. And we have been brainwashed little by little, here and there, in so many different ways, and we don't even realize it at times. God, I pray you would open up the eyes of our heart so that we may know you, who you designed us to be. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen. you have some discussion questions there, and we'll see you next week.